Good morning. Welcome to our roundtable panel, and we're very excited to be on. In fact, we should have been on at least 2 minutes ago, according to Rosemary.
I know. We're late.
So
for a very important day.
No time to say hello, goodbye. We're late. It is our roundtable panel. Joining us for the discussion this morning, WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. And good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. I need to be excused just a few minutes before the end, like
okay.
Rosemary did yesterday.
That's all right. We will,
it will be a habit.
We will get you out in time. I assure you.
Thank you, teacher.
Raise your hand before you go.
Yes. Political consultant Libby Post is with us. We have a full house this morning. Mm-hmm. We're very excited. Libby Post is here. And also, Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo joins us. And we have a special guest. And Rosemary, I'll let you introduce our very special guest, Vlad Larov, who is an investigative reporter and who you have brought to our region. And I can't believe our good fortune of all of the news that's breaking this morning to have a reporter from Kiev here, but go to it.
Right. Vlad and I have worked together in Eastern Europe. He's an amazing writer and reporter and has been intimately involved in what's happening in his country since, even before, but definitely since November when the protests began, when the government was overthrown, and now when, unbelievably, Ukraine has been brought to possibly the brink of a new Cold War, if not another World War. Hot War, exactly. So I've brought him to speak to our students, and I thought it might be great to have someone who actually has been in and seen Ukraine up close to talk about what he thinks.
We welcome your comments. Roundtable@wamc.org. Roundtable@wamc.org. When I got up this morning, I checked my iPad and I had all of the news alerts from the New York Times, and one came out and said there's a report of a ceasefire, and then another came out that there's a report of a Ukrainian Russian ceasefire, and then another report that said no, there was no ceasefire. So what do we make of the back and forth of all this fun?
I think at this point nobody can really tell what's going to happen, as it's been the case for the last 2-3 months. I think the only condition for the ceasefire possible, in my view, is that Russia stops supporting the separatist groups that are now operating in eastern Ukraine, and also closure of the border. Unfortunately, I have to say that Ukraine has no control of a large chunk of eastern country's border with Russia. So in this condition, I read in the morning the conditions for the ceasefire. There is nothing about Russia's seizing support of the troops there. There is nothing about Russia admitting it has troops there. And there is nothing about ensuring some kind of a control over the border. So I don't really believe in it.
It's hard. I mean, I guess that's, I mean, if it wasn't so serious and it wasn't so monumental, it would be laughable to say, well, there is no ceasefire because we're not at war. I mean, of making that kind of declaration.
Yeah, also that's the case. I don't know. Does it mean that Russia admits it's in war over there? It makes no sense to me at all. Because Russia has been saying that there are volunteers, there are Russian military volunteers over there, not the regular army.
Well, but we all know there are regular army there, and therefore we know that Putin is a liar. And no matter what he says, how can we believe any of it? Today, I just heard the headlines. Yeah.
I know that, but at the same time, we need sort of second opinion. And meanwhile, OSCE says that it's really difficult to establish if there is Russia's regular army there.
So where do we get the second opinion from?
I think monitors. There should be some solid presentation of international monitoring organizations over there who can say if there are troops or there are no troops.
How about NATO?
NATO?
NATO's an international organization. Can they go in and monitor?
You ask my permission?
Yeah.
No, I was really disappointed. Look, OSCE monitors have been in the area for a long time, and like yesterday, they say it's difficult to say. We cannot confirm. So it's pretty disappointing, all of this situation. It's laughable, but we can say that how do we have Russia admit that it has troops?
Right.
Now, if we were just listening to the news a couple of seconds ago, we heard that this, you could call anything you want ceasefire or not, but that Ukraine and Putin have arrived at a very close understanding, and that the two leaders are on the precipice of making an announcement. Do you believe it?
No, as I said, I saw the 7 points of what they come up with, and I don't see anything about controlling the border. Ukraine's regaining control of the border, and I don't see anything about Russia ceasing support to the terrorists. So it makes no sense to me.
Do you think Putin's boast is correct? Could he take Kiev in 2 weeks, and do you see that happening?
I don't see this happening, but I believe this. I believe he could, but I don't believe it would happen.
Why? Why do you think Putin is? He's just boasting.
I mean, is
the
saber
power?
Rattling at this point?
Well, at the moment in Ukraine, one of the very few positive things that happened in Ukraine is a very strong unification of society. There is a very strong development of civil society.
Interesting.
And there is very strong belief that we should be as far from Russia at the moment as possible. So to overtake Kyiv and the rest of Ukraine, Putin needs at least some kind of public support. I want to remind you, in case you didn't know, there is a very good opinion poll dated back in April. They were asking question, do you want to be Ukraine to be part of Russia? So in Crimea, 41% of people said yes. In eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk and Lugansk, less than 10% of people said yes. The rest of Ukraine, the numbers were almost at the statistical error. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yes, he could take Kyiv by force, but To sustain, to establish control of the country, he needs at least some part of people to support this. Otherwise, it's going to be a nightmare.
When were you last in Kyiv?
I live in Kyiv. I came from there on Monday.
Okay. So what is the reaction? I mean, can you get a feeling of what the mood is on the streets and of sort of the overall tenor of the place?
Actually, if you visited Kyiv these days, you would find it very relaxed and peaceful and enjoyable. You don't really see that the country is at war in Kyiv.
How about
on the
Donetsk?
Streets of Kyiv.
How about Eastern, one of the cities in Eastern Ukraine?
Those are totally empty cities. People avoid, sort of like Albany, actually.
Just because you were downtown at 3 a.m. is not a good indication of the nightlife.
Well, I don't know, Libby.
Yeah, I was trying to be a good citizen.
So Vlad, the
Central Avenue bid will be on our step here.
We heard this morning, we read this morning, that one of the other passing comments, I have no belief that he actually said this, from Putin, is that he could go nuke. Well, go nuke. What was he going to use his nukes for? I mean, it sounds crazy.
Sounds crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. But, do we still believe that Putin is a pragmatic leader who is reasonable and who he does say these things? Just as he said that he could take Kyiv over in 2 weeks.
Sure.
So he's not pragmatic anymore. He's believing his own headlines.
You know, I read an interview with him. I think it was last year. It was Ben Judah's article, I believe, in Newsweek, right? Mm-hmm. He made this very mm-hmm. long research. Mm-hmm. And I believe one point there. Putin says, I believe I'm right. I feel that I'm right. That's the way he governs the country.
Oh, we have
he
presidents has, who say God talks this, to them, so
yes,
we understand
it, it's sort of this thing. You can get carried away with this. Mm-hmm. It's dangerous to feel this way as a president. And in Russia, there is no public control over what he does. So he does, I think his inner feeling is that he's turned into some kind of messiah mm-hmm. who...
Yeah.
Bring back the Russian Empire.
Right.
So, if you could give advice to President Obama right now and the other Western leaders, what would you tell them to do? What would you like to see them acting on right now?
Imposing real real sanctions, strict sanctions. I sort of like the idea of banning Russia from using SWIFT for interbanking money transfers. That would virtually paralyze foreign trade of Russia. And also, I think it's about time to start sending high-tech weapons to Ukraine, because at the moment the army is in pretty bad shape, and you should know that the first 2 months of this war, the army was crowdsourced by the people.
Mm-hmm. People what were does that mean? Explain crowdsourcing.
It means that people were donating for the army. Since February, when this whole thing started, army was in such a bad shape that people had to donate their money, to donate clothing, to donate vests, to donate food and medicines for the army. There is a number of charity funds, and the government started allocating more money like only second months of the war. So you should imagine what state of the military is this.
Well, let me argue with you for a moment. Not argue with you, because I'm profoundly affected by what you say. But if we were to give, and I heard a very early a conversation with one of your top ministers this morning on the BBC, if we were to give big arms to Ukraine, would we not risk, since, I mean, under any circumstances, could that army, could your army, the army of Ukraine, overcome the Russians at any moment, no matter what they had in terms of arms? And B, wouldn't we risk the idea that those arms would fall into the hands of the Russians anyway?
The Middle East, where American arms are now equipping the horrible ISIS.
Okay, it's a reasonable question, but at the moment, but I think this sending more sophisticated weapons combined with more pressure on Russia and the sanctions, I think this could be effective, and not in the very least, it could lower the casualties, because at the moment I think Ukrainian army has about 30 dead people every single day. Yeah. So it won't make matters worse, if that's what you're saying.
I'm just asking.
How do you see the Poroshenko? Is his name the new president?
Mm-hmm.
How do you see him? Is he an effective leader? Is he somebody who can rally the troops as well as the people?
I think, I'm a journalist, so it would be wrong for me to praise any government.
Well, give
official.
Us your unbiased perspective.
I think it's a huge improvement over the last president. And also, I think, I would say that he is, he is probably the best president Ukraine has had so far. He hasn't done anything terribly wrong yet. But I understand that in his situation, I mean, it's not the best situation to be effective leader, you know. He is like a crisis manager, and that's always the most difficult part.
And how do the people of Ukraine perceive him? Does he have support, do you believe?
Before the elections, the common feeling was that we need to get this done as soon as possible. So people voted for him because he had the best chance to win in the first round. So that's how he got elected. He won by overwhelming majority, I think nearly 60%.
And what's his background? What's his strength?
He's a businessman. He is a chocolate king. He is a billionaire. He's a billionaire.
That's what I want in my president.
Winning the war with sweets.
A chocolate king.
No, but
the
actually,
Willy Wonka of... Right.
No, but actually in eastern Ukraine, they immediately hated all of his sweets, and he hated all of the sweets he produced, and even at some mass rallies, they would destroy the chocolates his company produced in public.
Like a Bloomberg rally.
Now the enemy says, the Russians say, you had an elected president. He was popularly elected, and you threw him out. Wasn't that illegal?
Well, Russia hasn't been saying for the last 3-4 months, if I believe correctly, As for overtaking the president, well, nobody banned mass protests. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ukraine still was a liberal, not very much totalitarian country when it took place. And I believe that people have the right to go against the government if it acts the way Mr. Yanukovych acted.
And
Russia dropped that line completely, if you noticed.
Okay.
Maybe the last time they said this was back in March. After the elections, I think after 3-4 weeks, they started calling the Poroshenko elected president.
And what about NATO? We're hearing this morning that that Ukraine has asked to become a member of NATO. Now, they know they're not going to be a member of NATO. What's the point of that?
Well, nobody can ban us from asking. And if you go back to 2008, if France and Germany didn't block Ukraine's NATO membership back then, I think none of this would happen at the moment.
Uh-huh.
So in some parts, they were the countries effectively blocking Ukraine's membership.
I just have to pause this because we have to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, our roundtable panel. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel this morning. We are very happy that you are with us, and we have a very special guest with us this morning. Vlad Larov is an investigative reporter and writer. He's a writer and an editor at the Kiev Post, an editor for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, and is with us this morning. We're talking about a lot of the events that are happening in Ukraine, as well as what has been happening. We're also joined by Alan Chartok and Libby Post and Rosemary Armeo, and we welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. The other story that I read, and we want to move on to other topics, and I certainly want to get to the Sotolov story and the tragedy there. But let us talk while we are on Ukraine about the story in the New York Times about the United Nations Refugee Agency saying yesterday that the fighting there has displaced more than 1 million people and warned of devastating consequences if it did not end soon. The number of people that the agency officially counts as displaced inside Ukraine has nearly doubled in the last 3 weeks to 260,000, but the actual number is much higher because many of those fleeing are staying with families and friends, according to Adrian Edwards, spokesman for the refugee agency, who was speaking to reporters in Geneva. I assume this is what you were talking about of the southern cities of that those cities are being vacated. So talk a little bit about the refugee issue.
Well, first of all, yes, I do believe these numbers. All of the people I knew in Donetsk are now either in Kyiv or in western Ukraine, so they effectively fled the situation there. And as I was in the eastern Ukraine, I traveled a lot all over the area, including some of the places where the displaced people went, where the displaced people fled. And it's been pretty terrible because they received virtually no support. They again had to rely on volunteers collecting food, collecting money, collecting clothing for them and delivering them to the areas where they now reside. But at the same time, I want to point out that a couple of months ago, Ukrainian military was pretty successful removing the separatist groups from the areas they occupied, and people were returning to those towns. The most famous example are Slavyansk and Kramatorsk that were under the separatist control for 2-3 months, and once they were liberated, people started returning back. So this problem could be solved if there is restoration of the government rule in the areas, I believe.
Ukrainian authorities are using a number of 2.2 million people still living in conflict areas in the country.
Yeah, it was one of the most heavily populated areas of Ukraine. So, yes, there are people still living there, but a lot of people went away.
I'll be Captain Obvious for a moment and just say that's a lot of people.
Yes.
Wow.
I was wondering at the break, we heard President Obama talking about Ukraine, and then he went on to talking about what happened in with the beheading. But what's his position? How do people view him?
That's a good question.
In Ukraine, by the Ukrainians, what do they think of Obama?
Well, at the moment, they think that there is better chance of getting some support from the U.S. than from the EU. The reason is obvious, because EU is very close economically with Russia. So I have to say that probably NATO and the United States is what Ukrainian people who support Ukrainian people count on most. But at the same time, we don't really see much support. The senators who come to Kyiv, they're far more outspoken, and they keep saying that more needs to be done. So as the official government, as the President Obama, I think we are still sort of waiting for real actions.
In the very not likely scenario, but you never know, of putting U.S. boots on the ground there, do you think the people would welcome that? Would it be something that people would want to see? Or do they just want aid, better weapons to fight the war themselves?
I don't think it's necessary. No, I don't believe there will be American boots on the ground, even though there was military exercise announced, including the US soldiers. But I don't think it's necessary at this point, because Ukraine has enough army as it is. It needs better training, it needs better weapons, it needs intelligence support, it sort of needs beefing up, so to speak. So why would we discuss this if it's not going to happen, and it's not really necessary at this point.
It's not going to happen. Exactly.
Vlad, who do you blame for this? How did Ukraine come to this pass?
Well, I know for sure that the former government is to blame. Because keep in mind that all of the country's richest people come exactly from the areas that are now under control of separatists. Those areas have been exploited, the resources have been exploited, people were exploited and very poorly paid, and people made billions out of it. And those billions went to support the former president Viktor Yanukovych, who's also made a fortune. So the people were virtually, I would say, raped there for many, many years by the former government and by the country's oligarchs. So when the regime was overthrown, when there was mass uprising in Kyiv, they sort of thought, why cannot we do the same? So those areas were extremely depressed economically, and people were very disillusioned. So that was initially, they thought that Russia would take them over just as well as Crimea, so they had this euphoria about better, easier life to come. So I think the root of the evil is the way the former governments did economic policy.
Now, there was some speculation, again, going back to the conversation this morning on Hard Talk with Stephen Sacker. There was some speculation by the minister who he was talking to, the Ukrainian minister, and I wish I remember who it was, but I don't, who said there was a virtual guarantee of protection from EU and when we gave up our missiles, because they had the largest number of missiles in the world there. That there was, don't worry, we'll always be here to protect you. So when the very excellent question gets asked, whose fault is this? To some degree, false promises were given.
Well, it was not just EU. It was EU countries and the United States as well. I think it was the Budapest Memorandum. Mm-hmm. So I think the four major countries basically guaranteed, including Russia, guaranteed Ukraine. Yes, it was the case. Nobody is fulfilling it now. It's not taken seriously at the moment.
Well, I mean, you're not a futurist, but what if the U.S. Really did everything that it could to to meet those guarantees. What do you think would happen? Would based on what you've seen up close of the Russians, could we have a world war?
We
had a World War I under less formal
circumstances. Lesser reasons, yeah.
Some Archduke's nephew.
It's a very unlikely scenario, but we should definitely keep this scenario in mind because it would be too reckless to ignore it completely. Mm-hmm. Yes, we should keep in mind this kind of development because, again, I don't believe that Putin is a pragmatic leader anymore. Yeah. I think he got carried away and nobody knows where it leads him.
Are you saying he's nuts?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Vlad, a question I asked you when I was driving you here. Do you feel bad about being here in the States? It's your first trip, I know, to the United States. Do you feel bad being here now when all of this is happening in Ukraine?
Again, as I told you, you get this feeling when things just begin. You always feel that tomorrow there is a major development and something is... But when these things last for so long...
Since last November.
Mm-hmm. You sort of lose the feeling that it's something extraordinary. You get used to this. So mm-hmm. At some point you need a break. So I basically consider this trip as a break.
So, and you know that when you get home, it'll still be there.
Yes. Unfortunately, but also, I mean, it's very important to try to live as normal life as possible. Under these circumstances, because if you start acting like you're at war while you're not, either go fight or try to live as normal life as possible, because otherwise you can go nuts.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and we'll let Alan exit. And thank you, Alan. And
thank you, Vlad. That was great.
And we will be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Green Conscience Home and Garden, Saratoga Springs, New York. A green design showroom dedicated to healthy interiors with non-toxic flooring, wall finishes, beds, and more. Green-conscience.com. And Hampshire Veterinary Hospital, corner of University Drive and Route 9 in Amherst, Massachusetts. Doctors Katz and Purdy, providing daily and on-call urgent veterinary care 24 hours every day. HampVet.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. Political consultant Libby Post is with us. Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo is here and has brought with her a special guest, Vlad Larov, who is an investigative reporter and writer at the Kiev Post. And we're thrilled that you are all here. It would be negligent to not change the subject and talk about the beheading, the second beheading of an American hostage in 2 weeks. An Islamic militant group released a video on Tuesday showing the second beheading of an American hostage and blamed President Obama for the killing. The video raised the pressure on the president to order military strikes on the group in its sanctuary in Syria. The hostage, Steven Sotloff, is shown in the video kneeling like the previous victim, James Foley, while a masked figure stands above wielding a knife. Mr. Sotloff addresses the camera and describes himself as paying the price for Mr. Obama's decision to strike the group, the Islamic State, in Iraq and Syria and northern Iraq. The apparent murder of Mr. Sotloff, 31 years old, came despite televised pleas from his mother to the leader of ISIS seeking mercy for her son, who was a freelance journalist who was captured in northern Syria a year ago. I think it's impossible, as with the James Foley case, not to hear this and just be sickened. And and you wonder, of course, you know, how much of it is true, and you know, do we take them at their word, and ultimately, how much does that matter? And then, what do we do now? What is the next
Well, Vlad and I sort of deal, not with beheadings, that's fortunately still a rare event, but we deal with danger that comes from work, investigative reporting all the time. And we take steps and you try to be measured, and we do have all kinds of safety procedures, both for our equipment and for ourselves and our data. But ultimately, if you're going to write about crime, corruption, war, and conflict, you take a certain risk. And I hope readers and listeners understand that that risk is real and worth it to the journalists who do it. I feel in this case for the journalists who tried to do a great job to try to show people what's happening in Syria and paid the ultimate price for it. And for their mothers, especially, as mm-hmm. a mother of sons, that Sotolov's mother put out an incredibly impassioned plea last week. And, of course, it was in vain. So I totally feel for them. But I am so grateful to have people who still take the risk that this guy did.
Yeah, I think if you're in areas like that, no matter what security procedures are in place, you're virtually all alone and on your own. So, especially if you are a freelancer, as I understand he was.
Yes. Right.
So, I think, yeah, no matter what is security measures, I mean, there is not much you can do in this case.
Mm-hmm. I can remember an investigative reporters and editors, which is a group of, you know, just like what it says, there would be meetings, national conferences, and people from places with oppressive governments or just bad governments would come and say, what measures can we take to protect ourselves? Asking American and Western journalists this. And the truth is, we don't come even close to taking the risks that these people do every day to bring news to people. They are really brave and important people. So I pay salute to him.
Are you afraid? Do you fear when you go back?
Well, if I go back to the conflict areas, yes, I'm afraid. It's a healthy feeling.
Vlad is worried about not having a vest right now.
Yeah, it helps you be mobilized. You shouldn't be reckless.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like the moment when you leave apartment and board the train. That's a pretty terrible moment. And that's why I avoid riding trains on my own. I always want to go with colleagues because it's easier. You can distract yourself from it. But yes, you should be. You should not feel bad about being afraid, as it helps you mobilized, and it helps. It sort of helps you make decisions.
Do you know who to be afraid of?
The one with guns.
Right. I mean, but
yeah,
is
but
it,
you
I mean,
wonder
is
if it's the ones without the guns who are working with the.
Let
ones
me
with
tell
the
you.
Is there a name and a face, or is it more mysterious than that?
No. When you travel the area, you are stopped at the checkpoints, and that's the moment when you have to do your best to pass. Mm. In addition, there is always the possibility of air attack or some other,
right.
But you cannot really control this.
No.
The checkpoints are the worst things because they decide if either to let you go or to catch you.
We have letters on the discussion, of course. A lot of people asking questions and talking about our discussion earlier on Ukraine. Steve writes, please comment on the eastward expansion of NATO in recent decades and how this might be perceived as a threat by Russia or be a genuine threat.
I think Russia overplays the danger in the eastward expansion. I think it's more psychological for them. I think they feel lesser great nation because of this. But I believe that there were solid mechanisms in place to ensure that, like, not agreement not to station large numbers of troops in the countries bordering Russia. I believe that was a solid mechanism. So I believe it's more about inferiority complex that Russian leaders have than about actual danger.
Steve is also asking for a comment on possible American involvement in the transition in power await last year, early this year in Ukraine, and possible threats to ethnic minorities, in particular Russian speakers, due to right-wing involvement in the new regime.
Well, I think that the recent events totally eliminated this problem. Ukraine now is a classical example of bilingual country, and even though one of the first decisions that the new government made was the cancellation of the law granting more rights to language minorities, then they backed down because they realized that it's not the way to go. So I have to tell to Steve that he should really not worry about the Russian-speaking minority in Ukraine. And in my own experience, I'm bilingual, but I prefer speaking Ukrainian. So in eastern parts of Ukraine, it's been a real problem. So it was better to switch to Russian because A, they wouldn't understand you, and B, you just don't feel comfortable. And I live in Kyiv. Kyiv is a classical example of bilingual city. So this, again, this problem has always been used by politicians to attract more votes from the eastern regions of the country because there are lots of people there. It's very important to get their votes. So this language issue has always been used by them. But what I see in the country right now, that this problem is gone completely.
Kenna writes, what may be the effect of Ukraine's struggles toward independence, toward developing civil society, and against corruption on Russian society?
I think that there are still many people in Russia who get their news not from state-owned TV and who have a pretty good idea what's really going on in Ukraine. And they somehow see Ukraine as sort of the example to follow, and sort of like they're hoping that one day something similar would happen in Russia. I mean, the transition to a more transparent, more democratic, more liberal society. So of course the Russian government doesn't like it, and they try to destroy whatever happens.
Vlad Larov is an investigative reporter and writer. He is a writer and editor at the Kyiv Post, and it's been a great pleasure to have you join us on the program
this morning.
Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. Rosemary Armeo, thank you so much for bringing Vlad along and for the great work you're doing, and for the opportunity you're giving the students to hear this
thank
very important
you.
Voice
yes.
as well. Libby, thank you very much for being here, and I look forward to seeing you next week, right?
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we'll figure that out. Excellent. We have work to do now.
That's right.
Thank you very much. We will be back in our next hour of the Roundtable and talk to A. Scott Berg about his new biography of Woodrow Wilson. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.